He doesn't come out unless it's your watch. One eye keeps the ship in trim, but the other...
What? I said, sensing already that he was right.
He's always watching you,
Foley said, looking around at the others for confirmation.
And there's nothing but hatred in his eye.
The others nodded in agreement. But why? I asked.
He's waiting, wanting you to make a mistake, Morgan put in, taking a deep pull on his pipe, then filling the forecastle with its acrid smoke.
What kind of mistake? I asked.
Something he can use against you. Something to set him right. Look here, Charlotte, you boxed him in.
I did?
It was that first moment you joined us. You mentioned your father, didn't you? Said he'd approve of what you've done?
He would. He believes in justice.
Be that as it may, Jaggery didn't know what to do. He gave way. Not a thing he likes, you know. So now I say he's waiting for a mistake on your part to set himself back up.
I don't intend to make a mistake, I stated proudly. Fisk spat upon the floor.
Neither does he.
It came to pass as Morgan promised. To a person on land, the sight of a ship's sails, bleached by sun, stretched by wind, is the very image of airy lightness. In fact, a sail is made of very heavy canvas. When one gets tangled on a spar, it must be pulled loose quickly, or it can tear or burst, and in so doing, pull down rigging, spars, even a mast. A sail out of control can flick like a wild whip, and send a full-grown sailor into a senseless spin. It often happens. Now the flying jib is set at the furthest point of the bowsprit, at the very tip of it. When you consider that the bow of a speeding ship on a high sea forever rises and falls, you will perceive that a broken jib can dip into the sea itself. Such is the water's force, and the driving of the ship, that the bowsprit itself can be caused to snap. Thus, the sailor who seeks to repair a tangled jib must contend not only with a heavy, flailing sail, but the powerful, rushing sea only a few feet, sometimes closer, below him. One afternoon, 2 days after our forecastle talk and during my watch, the flying jib became entangled in just the way I have described. As soon as he saw it, Captain Jaggery cried,
"Mr. Doyle, fix the bowsprit."
In his haste to call on me, he spoke directly, not through one of his mates. Before I could respond, Grimes leaped forward, calling,
"I'll do it, sir."
Grimes was one of the bearded ones, quick to flare, quick to forget.
"The call was for Mr. Doyle," returned the captain. "Does he refuse?"
"No, sir," I said, and hurried to the knighthead from which the bowsprit thrust forward. Grimes hurried along with me, offering hasty instructions in my ear, as well as urging a splicing knife upon me. I took it and put it in a pocket.
"Charlotte, do you see that line out there?" he asked, pointing to the twisted line at the far end of the bowsprit that had snarled the jib.
I nodded.
"Don't monkey with the sail itself. All you need do is cut the rope. The sail will free itself, and we've got others. Mind, you'll need to cut sharp, then swing down under the bowsprit in one quick jump, or the sail will toss you in. Understand?"
Again I nodded.
"Time yourself proper. If the ship plunges, the sea will up and grab you."
So cocky had I become that I leaped to the head rail with little thought or worry, then set my foot upon the bowsprit itself. I saw that I needed to walk out along this bowsprit some 20 feet. Not too difficult a task, I thought, because the back rope was something I could cling to. As I had by now learned to do, I started off by keeping my eyes on the bowsprit and my bare feet, inching step by step along it. The hiss of the water rushing below was pronounced. The bowsprit itself, wet and slippery with foam. No matter. What took me by surprise was the bowsprit's wild bobbing. Halfway along, I glanced back. For the first time since I'd boarded the ship, I saw the figurehead clearly, the pale white seahawk with wings thrust back against the bow, its head extended forward, beak open wide in a scream. As the bow dipped, this open beak dropped and dropped again into the sea, coming up each time with foam streaming like a rabid dog. So startled was I by the frightful vision that for a moment I froze until a sudden plunge of the ship almost tumbled me seaward. I reached the crucial point soon enough, but only by curling my toes tight upon the bowsprit, and holding fast onto the back rope line with one hand was I able to free the other to take Grimes's splicing knife from my pocket. I leaned forward and began to cut. The tightness of the tangled line helped. The knife cut freely. Too much so. The last remaining strand snapped with a crack. The sail boomed out, flicking away at my cutting hand, and the knife went flying into the sea. Even as I lunged for it, the bowsprit plunged. I slipped and started to fall. By merest chance, I made a successful grab at the bowsprit itself, which left me hanging, feet dangling, only a few feet above the rushing sea. As the seahawk plunged and plunged again, I was dunked to my waist, to my chest. I tried to swing myself up, to hook my feet over, but I could not. The sea kept snatching at me, trying to pull me down while I dangled there, kicking wildly, uselessly. Twice my head went under. Blinded, I swallowed water, choked. Then I saw that only by timing my leg swings to the upward thrust of the ship could I save myself. The ship heaved skyward. With all my might, I swung my legs up and wrapped them about the bowsprit. But again the Seahawk plunged. Into the tearing sea I went, clutching the spar. Then up. This time I used the momentum to swing over, so I was now atop the bowsprit, straddling it, then lying on it. Someone must have called to the man at the helm. The ship shifted course, found easier water, slowed, ceased to plunge so. Gasping for breath, spitting seawater, I was able to pull myself along the bowsprit, and finally, by stepping on the wooden bird's furious head, climbed over the rail. Grimes was there to help me onto the deck and give me an enthusiastic hug of approval. The captain, of course, watched me stony-faced.
"Mr. Doyle," he barked, "come here."
Though greatly shaken, I had no time to be frightened. I had done the task, and I knew I'd done it. I hurried to the quarter-deck.
"When I ask you to do a job," the captain said, "it's you I ask and not another. You've caused us to change course, to lose time." And before I could respond, he struck me across the face with the back of his hand, then turned and walked away. My reaction was quick.
"Coward!"
I screamed at him.
"Fraud!"
He spun about and began to stride back toward me, his scarred face contorted in rage. But I, in a rage myself, wouldn't give way.
"I can't wait till Providence," I shouted at him. "I'll go right to the courts. You won't be Captain Long. You'll be seen by everyone as the cruel despot you are."
And I spat upon the deck by his boots. My words made him turn as pale as a ghost with murder in his eye. But then, abruptly, he gained control of himself and, as he'd done on previous occasions, whirled about and left the deck. I turned away, feeling triumphant. Much of the crew had seen it all. But there were no more hurrahs. The moment passed. Nothing more was said, save by Grimes, who insisted that I take lessons in the handling of a knife, carrying it, using it, even throwing it. On my first watch off, he had me practice on the deck for 3 hours. 2 more days passed without incident. In that time, however, the sky turned a perpetual gray. The air thickened with moisture. Winds rose and fell in what I thought was a peculiar pattern. Toward the end of the second day, when Barlow and I were scraping down the capstan, I saw a branch on the waves. A red bird was perched on the branch. "Look!" I cried with delight, pointing to the bird. "Does that mean we're close to land?" Barlow hauled himself up to take a look. He shook his head.
"That bird's from the Caribbean, 1,000 miles off. I've seen them there. Blood bird, they call them."
"What's it doing here?" After a moment he said,
"Storm driven."
I looked at him in surprise. "What kind of a storm would blow a bird that far?" I asked, wide-eyed.
"Hurricane."
"What's a hurricane?"
"The worst storm of all."
"Can't we sail around?" Barlow again glanced at the helm, the sails, and then at the sky above. He frowned.
"I heard Mr. Hollybrass and Jaggery arguing about it. To my understanding," he said, "I don't think the captain wants to avoid it."
"Why not?"
"It's what Grimes has been saying. The captain's trying to move fast. If he sets us right at the hurricane's edge, it'll blow us home like a pound of shot in a 2-pound cannon."
"What if he doesn't get it right?"
2 pounds of shot in a 1-pound cannon."
Chapter 15. 2 bells into the morning of our 45th day, the storm struck.
"All hands, all hands!"
Even as the cry came, the Seahawk pitched and yawed violently. Whether I got out of my hammock on my own, or was tossed by the wrenching motion of the ship, to this day I do not know. But I woke to find myself sprawling on the floor, the curtain torn asunder, the forecastle in wildest confusion. Above my head, the lantern swung grotesquely. The men's possessions skittered about like billiard balls. Trunks rolled helter-skelter. The watch was scrambling up. As the ship plunged and plunged again, the cry, "All hands! All hands!" came repeatedly, more urgent than I'd ever heard it.
"Hurricane!"
I heard as well. There was a frantic dash out of the forecastle into the deck. I followed too, trying to pull on my jacket as I ran against the violent pitching of the ship. Though long past dawn, the sky was still dark. A heavy rain, flung wildly by wind that screamed and moaned like an army in mortal agony, beat upon the deck in rhythms only a mad drummer could concoct. The sea hurled towering wall upon towering wall of foaming fury over us. One such tossed me like some drop of dew across the deck, where I, fortunately, crashed against a wall. As I lay stunned and bruised, gasping for breath, I caught sight of Mr. Hollybrass and Captain Jaggery in the midst of a furious dispute.
"No profit to be found at the bottom of the sea," I heard the first mate cry above the storm. "Mr. Hollybrass, we sail through,"
the captain returned, breaking away to shout,
"All hands aloft! All hands aloft!"
I could hardly believe my ears, to go up into the rigging in this. But when I looked skyward, I could see the reason why. Under the brutal force of the wind, many of the sails had pulled free from their running ropes, and were now tearing and snapping out of control, pulling themselves into wild whips.
"All hands aloft! All hands aloft!"
came the cry again. It was pleading, desperate. I could see the men, bent far over to buck wind and rain, struggling toward the shrouds. I pulled myself to my feet, only to be knocked down by still another wave. Again I staggered up, grasping a rope, managing to hold on with the strength of my 2 hands. Now I was able to stand, but just barely. Slowly I made my way toward the forward mast. When I reached it, it seemed to take forever. Captain Jaggery was already there, trying frantically to lash down ropes and rigging. "What shall I do?" I shouted to his back. Shouting was the only way I could make myself heard.
"Cut away the foreyard before it pulls the mast down,"
he yelled back. I'm not certain he realized it was me.
"Do you have a knife?"
he called.
"No,"
Even as he reached into a back pocket, he turned. When he saw it was me, he hesitated. "A knife!" I cried. He handed one to me. "Where?" I called. "Didn't you hear me?" he cried, gesticulating wildly. "Cut that sail away." I looked up. I could not see far into the sheets of rain. The Seahawk's wild pitching had set the mast shaking as if it had the palsy. Only the foreyard was visible, and the sail was blowing from it almost into the shape of a balloon. Suddenly the sail collapsed into itself, then filled again. It would burst soon, or fly off with the mast.
"Up, damn you! Up, hurry!"
Captain Jaggery screamed. I reached into the rigging, but stopped, realizing I couldn't climb and hold the knife. With the blade between my teeth, I again grasped the rigging, and using both hands I began to climb. Though I was in fact climbing into the air, I felt as though I were swimming against a rising river tide. But more than rain or waves, it was the screaming wind that tore at me. I could hardly make out where I was going. To make matters worse, my wet and heavy hair, like a horse's tail, kept whipping across my face. I might have been blindfolded. Desperate, I wrapped my legs and one arm about the ropes. With my one free arm, I pulled my hair around, grasped it with the hand entwined in the ropes, and pulled it taut. I took the knife and hacked. With a shake of my head, my 13 years' growth of hair fell away. Feeling much lighter, I bit down onto the blade again, and once more began to climb. Every upward inch was a struggle, as though I were forcing myself between the fingers of God's angry fist. And it was not just the elements that attacked. Below me, when I dared to look, the deck blurred into a confusing mass of water, foam, decking, and now and again a struggling man. I was certain the Seahawk would flounder, that we were doomed to drown. I told myself not to look, to concentrate on what I had to do. Up I went. The rain hissed. Thunder boomed. Lightning cracked. Human cries came too, shouts that rose up through the maelstrom, words I couldn't catch. But what they betokened was terror. As I crept further up the mast, the sail billowed out and away from me. The next moment the wind shifted, and the great canvas collapsed, smashing its full wet weight against me, as though with a conscious mind to knock me from the rigging. Desperately I clung to the ropes with legs and arms. Then out the sail snapped. The ensuing vacuum all but sucked me off. God knows how, but I held on and continued up. I heard, threaded through the wailing wind, a ghastly shrieking sound, then a tremendous splintering of wood. Could it, I wondered, be my mast? Was I about to be hurled into the waves? I dared not stop and think, but the mast held. Hand over hand, foot after foot, I struggled upward. I was certain we were all about to die. Whether above the waves or beneath them, it hardly seemed to matter. All I wanted was to reach that sail, as if by doing so I could rise above the chaos. To cut that sail free was my only purpose. I would not, could not, think of anything else. Sometimes I paused just to hang on, to gasp for breath, to remind myself I lived. But then, once again, I continued up. It felt like hours. It probably took minutes. At last I reached my goal. The foreyard is one of the biggest sails, one of a sailing ship's true engines. But even though it worked hard for the ship under normal circumstances, in this storm it strained against her, as if trying to uproot the mast from the deck. Despite the roaring wind that beat about me, I could hear the creaking of the mast, could see it bend like a great bow. What I needed to do, had to do, was cut that sail free and release the terrible strain upon the mast. Fearful of wasting any time, I simply straddled the spar to which the sail's top edge was lashed and backed out toward its end, hacking away at each piece of rope as I came upon it. Fortunately, the lines were so taut and the blade so sharp, I hardly had to cut. The moment I touched a rope with the knife's edge, strands flew apart as if exploding. With each rope I cut, the sail blew out more freely, flapping in such frenzy it began to shred into tiny strands that I could no longer distinguish from the streaking rain. Bit by bit I moved along, cutting as I went, until I reached the spar's furthest end. There I had to make another decision. Should I cut the lines that held the spar itself? What would happen if I did so? If I did not? I looked about in the vain hope that another of the crew might be near. To my surprise, I did see the shadowy form of someone above, but who he was I couldn't tell. In any case, he was climbing farther up the mast than I. I decided not to cut more lines. Someone else could do so if that's what needed to be done. My job was to cut away the rest of the sail, which meant going back the way I'd come, and proceeding out along the spar toward the opposite end. The spar, however, with its lopsided weight, and me at one end, was swinging and lurching about so wildly I feared it might break free and drop with me on it. I had to get back to the mast. But the foot ropes were gone. In my wild hacking, I'd cut them free too. I would have to drag myself along. With the knife again clamped between my teeth, arms tightly locked around the spar, I flung myself down and tried to slide forward. But at the next lurch of the spar, my legs slipped away. The knife fell from my mouth. In a small part of a second, I was now dangling, legs down, facing away from the mast, about to drop into the wildest scene imaginable. I had no choice. I now had to clamber, hand over hand and backward, toward the mast. But as much as I tried for speed, I could move only in tiny increments. The wind and rain, as well as the tossing motion of the ship, kept impeding me. I was dangling in the hurricane winds, twisting. Over my shoulder, I could see that the mast was not far out of reach. But then my arms began to cramp. "Help!" I screamed. "Help me!" One hand lost its grip. 4 feet from the mast, I tried to swing myself back in the vain hope of grasping the mast with my legs. The attempt only weakened my hold more. I was certain I was going to drop. "Help!" I screamed into the wind. Suddenly, a figure appeared on the spar.
"Charlotte!" I heard. "Take my hand."
And indeed, a hand was thrust toward my face. I reached for it frantically, grabbed it, clung to it, as it clung to me, its fingers encircling my wrist in an iron grip. For a moment I was hanging by that one hand. Then I was yanked upward onto the spar so I could get my legs around it and locked. Gasping for breath, I glanced up at the figure who was now scrambling away. It was Zachariah. For one brief moment, I was certain I had died, and he was an angel. But I hardly had time for thought, for just above me I heard a great wrenching explosion. I looked up to see that the foreyard had ripped away. As the sail spun off in the wind, I caught a glimpse of its gray mass twisting and turning into oblivion like a tormented soul cast down to hell. I spun back around. The man I thought to be Zachariah had vanished. But even as I gazed in wonder, the Seahawk, free from the sail's pull and weight, heeled violently. To my horror, I saw the ocean rush up toward me. We were capsizing. But then suddenly, the ship shivered and righted herself. Gasping for breath, I clawed my way forward until I reached the mast, which I hugged as though it were life itself. Without the knife, there was nothing more I could do aloft. In any case, the sail I had been sent to free was gone. I began to descend, slipping more than I climbed. I jumped the last few feet onto the deck. I don't know if the storm had somewhat abated, or I'd just grown used to it. There were still strong winds, and the rain beat upon us as before, but the fury of the hurricane somehow softened. I looked about. Spars, some entangled with sails, lay in heaps. Railings were splintered. Dangling ropes flapped about. Then I saw some of the men on the quarter-deck working frantically with axes. I hurried to join them. Only then did I realize the mainmast was gone. All that remained was a jagged stump. I thought of the shriek I'd heard. Looking toward the stern, I saw Fisk slumped over the wheel. His great arms were spread wide, his hands clutching the wheel spokes. He could not have stayed upright had he not been lashed into place. I joined the men. Beneath the continual, if now somewhat slackened downpour, we all pulled at the great mound of downed spars and sails. Those that were dragging overboard, we cut loose and let go. Those we could move, we flung into the waist. And then, quite suddenly, as if heaven itself had triumphed over darkness, the rain ceased. The sea subsided into a roiling calm. Even the sun began to shine. And when I looked up, I saw, to my astonishment, a blue sky. "It's over," I said breathlessly. Mr. Johnson shook his head.
"Nothing like," he warned. "It's the eye of the storm. There'll only be a pause, and it'll be back in 20 minutes going the other way. But, God willing, if we can clear the deck, we may be able to ride it out."
I looked up at our remaining mast. Only the topgallant was left. The other sails had been cut loose. Working frantically, we reached the bottom of the pile. It was Foley who pulled away the last torn sail. There, beneath it, lay Mr. Hollybrass, face down. A knife was stuck in his back, plunged so deeply only the scrimshaw handle could be seen. I recognized the design of a star. This was the dirk Zachariah had given me. The sight of the dead Mr. Hollybrass, for it was certain that such was the case, left us all dumbfounded. But after all we'd been through in the storm, it's hardly to be wondered that we made no response. We were too drained, too numb.
"What is it?" came a voice.
We turned to see Captain Jaggery. He was looking much like the rest of us, wild and disheveled. We stepped aside. No one said a word. He came forward. For a moment, he too did nothing but stare at the body. Then he knelt and touched the man's face, the back of his neck. For a moment he hesitated, then pulled Mr. Hollybrass's arm from where it lay twisted under his body. The dead man clutched something in his hand. The captain managed to pry the fingers open and plucked away what Mr. Hollybrass had been holding. He held it up. It was my handkerchief. The captain now used that handkerchief to grasp the handle of the knife and pull it from the dead man's back. He stood up. He was looking directly at me. At last he turned toward the sky. It was darkening again, and the sea had begun to heave in growing swells.
"We shall have 15 more minutes before the storm returns," he announced. "I want this body removed and placed in the steerage. In the available time, the rest of you clear the deck. Mr. Johnson's watch shall man the pumps first. 2 from Mr. Hollybrass's watch will hold the wheel, and the rest can stay in the forecastle. I will call the rotation. Now, quickly!"
The captain's orders were carried out in silence. Dillingham and Grimes took Mr. Hollybrass's body below. The rest of us roamed the decks alone or in pairs, flinging broken bits of mast, sail, and spar into the sea, or trying to tie down what was possible to save by lashing it on deck. I followed along, doing what I could, my mind a jumble. Not a word was spoken regarding Mr. Hollybrass or his death. As extraordinary as the event was, there was no time, no mind to consider it. As predicted, the storm struck within the quarter hour, and with as much fury as before. But the Seahawk, with one mast and but a single sail hung, was more fit to ride it out. I rushed to the top cargo where the pumps were. They were simple suction pumps, each capable of being worked by as few as two. But four we were, Grimes, Keach, Mr. Johnson, and myself, who heaved the handles in the cold, wet, and lurching darkness, as though our lives depended upon it, which they did. Again the Seahawk became a mere toy to the elements. Wind shrieked and howled. More than once water poured over us from above, or the ship heeled to the gunwales, bringing hearts to mouths. For the merest second, we would balance on the brink of capsizing, while we pumped with greater will than ever. It was as if that rhythmic action was the true beating of our own hearts, as if, were we to stop for more than a moment, the heart of the ship might cease all beating too. To work meant to live, and work we did for upwards of 3 hours. Then we were released. I was sent to the forecastle to rest, along with Morgan, Barlow, and Fisk. Morgan searched for his tobacco pouch, but most personal belongings were flung about and broken, and those still whole were soaking wet. He swore in frustration. "Be glad you're breathing air, lad," Fisk said wearily. Chilled to the bone, exhausted, I tumbled into a hammock and tried to sleep. But I'd hardly closed my eyes before I was called out again. Now I was to stand to the wheel. The captain was there. To his credit, he remained at the helm throughout the storm, calling upon us to attempt this adjustment or that, anything to keep our stern toward the wind. Barlow, my partner, did most of the work. Great strength was wanted just to hold the wheel steady. Whatever strength I had was fast ebbing. I was frozen, miserable. It did not matter. From duty at the wheel, I returned to the pumps. From the pumps to the forecastle. Thence again to the wheel. Round and again, perhaps 3 times in all, I lost count. At last, some 17 hours after we'd first been called out, the storm abated. I was allowed to return to my hammock, where, spent and shivering, I closed my eyes. On the edge of sleep, I suddenly recalled the visitation of Zachariah and the demise of Mr. Hollybrass. This thought of the dead served to remind me that I was still alive, and that consolation eased my body and calmed my mind. Within seconds, I slept the sleep of the dead, who wait, with perfect equanimity, upon the final judgment. Chapter 16. It was 14 hours before I woke. If I'd known that much time had passed, I'd have realized something was amiss. No matter what the circumstances, it's irregular for any member of a crew to be allowed to sleep so long. For the moment, however, I remained in my hammock, blithely assuming it was simply not yet time for my normal watch. The canvas curtain had been restrung and was drawn closed, but that was the type of kindness Barlow or Ewing would have done. The familiar sounds of the running ship comforted me, and the truth is, despite the fact that my shirt and trousers were still damp, my body one great ache, I was enjoying my rest, thanking God and Zachariah I was alive. Suddenly I sat up. But Zachariah died. I had seen him beaten to death, committed to the sea. Was it his ghost, then, who had saved me? I remembered thinking of an angel. Had I hallucinated the moment? Made a story of it for myself? It was like the kind of forecastle yarn I'd heard the sailors tell so often. I had not believed them. Not then. And yet, what was I to think, other than that a miracle had transpired? That, I told myself, was absurd. but I had not imagined it. I remembered the man's iron grip. Someone had helped me. Someone other than Zachariah. It had to be. But who? I reached from my hammock and drew back the canvas curtain. I was alone. Puzzled, I got up quickly and ran from the forecastle onto the deck. What I saw was as perfect a sky as any deep-water sailor could wish. The sun was warm, the breeze, out of the west, strong and even. And the deck was in good order, as if the storm had been but a dream. Even the foremast and bowsprit were fully rigged, their sails taut. Only the jagged stump of the mainmast, on the quarter-deck, stood testimony to the last 24 hours. How much the men had accomplished while I slept! I felt forgotten. There was Barlow, there was Morgan, Foley. It was my watch to be on duty. But why hadn't I been called? Then I realized that both watches were on deck. When I saw Ewing and Keach working near at hand, I went to them. "Ewing," I called. "Keach." Both men turned about. Instead of giving me his regular, casual greeting, "Morning to you, lass," Ewing stopped his work and gaped at me with a frown that signaled I knew not what. It gave me sudden pause. I glanced at Keach, whose pinched face bore his familiar rabbit look of fear. But like Ewing, he said nothing. "Why wasn't I called?" I asked.
"Called?" Ewing echoed dumbly.
"My watch." They offered no explanation. "Answer me." Ewing sighed.
"Charlotte, we were told not to."
"Told? Who told you?"
"It's not for us to say, miss," Keach whispered.
"You're not to call me miss," I cried out in exasperation. "Are you going to tell me or not?"
Ewing looked at me reluctantly. "It's Hollybrass. His murder."
I had put that completely out of my mind. "What's that to do with not calling me?" I demanded, drawing closer. Ewing sprang up and backed away, as if frightened. I turned to Keach, but he seemed suddenly absorbed in his work. "Something else has happened, hasn't it?" I said, more and more apprehensive. "What is it?"
"It's the captain, miss," Keach began.
"Charlotte!" I broke in angrily. Keach drew a hand across his mouth as if to stop it. "What has happened?" I persisted. "Are you going to tell me or not? Is it some secret?"
Ewing licked his lips. Keach seemed to be avoiding my eyes. But it was he who said, "The captain told us, when we was committing Hollybrass to the sea, that—"
Now his darting eyes flicked toward me, then away.
"It was you that murdered him."
My breath all but failed. "Me?" I managed to get out.
"Aye, you."
"Who could believe such a thing?" I exclaimed. "How? Why?"
"To avenge Zachariah's death," Ewing whispered.
I stood there, open-mouthed. "But Zachariah—" I began, not even sure what I was about to say. The former second mate looked around at me, his eyes narrowed.
"What about Zachariah?" he asked, standing up.
"He's dead," I said lamely.
"He's all of that," Ewing agreed.
Keach began to move away quickly. Ewing started to follow. I grabbed his arm. "Ewing," I said, "do you think I did it?" He shook his arm free.
"Captain says that dirk was yours."
"Ewing, I left that dirk in my old cabin."
"That's what Captain said you'd say."
I took in his meaning. "You believe him, don't you?" He studied his hand. "And the others?" I wanted to know.
You'll have to ask them. Deeply shaken, I started for the galley in search of Fisk, but changed my mind. It was Captain Jaggery I had to see. I turned and headed for his cabin, but before I had taken 5 steps, I was confronted by the captain himself coming to the quarter-deck. I stopped in surprise. The man before me was not the same Captain Andrew Jaggery I'd seen on the quarter-deck the first day we sailed. True, he still wore his fine clothes, but the jacket was soiled and showed any number of rips. A cuff was frayed, a button gone. Small points, perhaps, but not for a man of his fastidiousness. And the whip mark, though no longer so pronounced, had become a thin white line, like a persistent, painful memory.
"Miss Doyle," the captain proclaimed for all to hear, "I charge you in the willful murder of Mr. Hollabrass."
I turned to appeal to the crew, only recently my comrades, who stood looking on. "I did not do it," I said.
"Have no fear, Miss Doyle. You shall have a jury of your peers, and a speedy trial."
"It's a lie," I said.
"Mr. Barlow,"
the captain called, never for a moment turning his cold eyes from me. Barlow shuffled forward.
"Take the prisoner to the brig,"
the captain said, offering up a key that Barlow took.
"Miss Doyle, your trial for murder will commence at the first bell of the first dog watch today."
"Come along, miss," Barlow whispered.
I shrank back.
"Easy, Charlotte," he went on. "I'll not do you harm."
His words reassured me somewhat, but no other words of comfort came. The central hatch cover was slid back. Barlow beckoned me to it, and under the eyes of all he followed me down the ladder. We passed by the top cargo, where Barlow lit a lantern, then groped our way into the hold, the bottom of the ship. I had avoided even thinking of the place since the incident of the false head. As far as I could see, which was not very far, it was like some long-forgotten, tunneled dwelling faced with great wood timbers and rough planking, grown corrupt with green slime. The area was crammed with barrels and cases, among which only a narrow passageway of planking had been left. Barlow led me forward as the blackened bilge lapped below. The stench was loathsome. A few feet ahead, I saw the brig. Not so much a room as a cage of iron bars with a gate for a door. I could make out a stool for sitting, a pan for slops, nothing more. Had Cranick, poor man, been its last inhabitant? Barlow unlocked the rusty padlock on the gate. It took a yanking to free it.
"You'll want to go in," he said.
I hesitated. "You'll leave the light, won't you?" I asked. Barlow shook his head.
"If it tumbled, we'd have a fire."
"But it will be completely dark." He shrugged. I stepped inside. Barlow closed the gate and locked it. For a moment I just stood helplessly, watching him move away. Suddenly frightened, I called, "Barlow!" He paused to peer back over a shoulder. "Do you think I killed Mr. Hollabrass?" He considered for a moment.
"I don't know, Charlotte," he said wearily.
"You must think someone did," I cried, wanting to hold him there as much as I wanted answers.
"I don't know as I allow myself to think," he offered, and made hastily for the ladder.
Utterly discouraged, I remained standing in the dark. All about me I heard the hollow groans of the ship, the cargo creaking, water dripping and sloshing, rustling, a sudden squeaking of rats. Nearly sick with fright, I felt about for the stool. I sank down upon it, reminding myself I wouldn't have to stay there for long. Captain Jaggery had promised a trial for that very day. But what kind of trial? Zachariah's words filled my head, that a captain is sheriff, judge, jury. And Hangman, too. Shivering, I bent over and hugged myself to my knees. Without the crew on my side, I would be hard put to prove my innocence. I knew that. Yet they seemed to have turned against me. Of all misfortunes, that was the most hurtful to bear. I shifted the stool so I could lean back against the rear bars of the brig, then closed my eyes against the dark. I ran my fingers through my hair, but the gesture only reminded me I'd hacked it short. For a brief moment, I caught a distant vision of myself as I had been before the Seahawk, before this tumultuous voyage. Was it days or years that had passed since? I was speculating thus when I heard a different kind of noise. At first I ignored it, but when it came again, a slow, hesitant sound, almost like a human step, I opened my eyes wide and stared into the dark. Was this too my imagination? The sound grew closer. My heart began to pound. "Who's there?" I called out. After a moment I heard,
"Charlotte, is that you?"
I leaped to my feet. "Who is it?" I cried. By way of answer, the shuffling drew closer, then suddenly stopped. Now I was certain I heard labored breathing. A spark burst forth, then a tiny light. Before me loomed the ancient head of Zachariah. Chapter 17. His face appeared to be floating in air. Terrified, I could only stare into his hollow and unseeing eyes, for so they seemed in the flickering light.
"Is that you, Charlotte?" came a voice,
his voice. "What are you?" I managed to ask. The head drew closer.
"Don't you know me?"
the voice said. I stammered, "Are you real?"
"Charlotte, don't you see me?"
came the voice, more insistent than before. Now the light, it was a small candle, was held up, and I could see more of him. The very image of Zachariah, but sadly altered, too. In life he had never appeared strong or large. In death he'd become shriveled, gray-bearded. "What do you want?" I demanded, shrinking back into the furthest corner of the brig.
"To help you?" the voice said.
"But you died," I whispered. "I saw your funeral. They wrapped you in your hammock and dropped you into the sea." A soft laugh. His laugh.
"Close to death, surely, Charlotte, but not altogether dead. Come, touch me. See for yourself."
Cautiously, I moved forward, reached out, and touched his hand. Real flesh, and warmth. "And the hammock?" I wondered in astonishment. He laughed again.
"A full hammock, to be sure, but empty of me. It's an old sailor's trick. No doubt if I'd remained in Jaggery's hands, I would have died."
"Have you been in the hold all along?"
"Ever since."
I could only stare.
"Keach brings me food and water every day," he continued. "The food's not as good as I would have prepared, but enough to keep me alive. And look here, Charlotte. If poor Cranach could hide, why not Zachariah? It was Keach's notion."
"Why wasn't I told?"
"It was decided not to tell you."
"Why?"
"You forget, Charlotte. You informed upon us."
"That was then, Zachariah," I said, my face burning.
"True enough. And I have been told about you, young soul of justice. There's much to be admired. I salute you."
"I wanted to fill your place." He smiled.
"Didn't I once say how much we were alike? A prophecy. But you're not regretting I'm alive, are you?
No, of course not. But if I hadn't caught sight of you during the storm, would I ever have seen you?
I cannot say.
The captain might have discovered you then. Why did you come up?
What would be the point of staying here and perishing when I could have been of help?
You saved me from falling.
One shipmate helps another.
But what about Captain Jaggery? I asked. Does he know you're here?
Now, Charlotte, do you think if he believed me alive, he'd allow me here for even a moment? Do you?
I suppose not, I admitted.
There you are. That's all the proof I need that he doesn't know. The hope is this, he went on. When the Seahawk reaches Providence, not very long from now, I understand, you shall see. Jaggery will keep the crew on board, not wanting them to talk to anyone. But I'll be able to get off, and when I do, I'll go to the authorities to expose him for what he is. Now, what do you think?
Even as I grasped the plan, I felt a pang of embarrassment that compelled me to turn away.
What's the matter?
The pain in my heart made it impossible for me to speak.
Tell me, he coaxed.
Zachariah...
What?
You're... a black man.
That I am. But this state of Rhode Island where we're going, it has no more slaves.
He suddenly checked himself.
Or am I wrong?
A black man, Zachariah, a common sailor, testifying against a white officer. I didn't have the heart to finish.
Ah, but Charlotte, didn't you once tell me it was your father who's part of the company that owns the Seahawk? You did. The plan is to go to him. You'll give me a good character, won't you? And if he's like you, there's nothing to fear.
A tremor of unease passed through me. I wasn't sure what to say. I stole a glance at him. What about Cranick? I asked. Did he die? Truly?
More's the pity, he said with a shake of his head and a lapse into silence.
Then he looked up.
Now then, he said, I have talked too much of myself. I saw Barlow bring you here and lock you in. Did you mock Jaggery again?
I was taken aback. Didn't anyone tell you?
Tell me what?
Zachariah, Mr. Hollybrass was murdered.
Murdered, he cried. When?
During the storm.
I wasn't told.
Why not?
I cannot imagine.
He grew thoughtful, and even glanced toward the ladder. Then, abruptly, he turned back to me and said,
"But what's that to do with you?"
"Zachariah, it's the reason I'm here. The captain has accused me."
"You?"
Again he seemed surprised. I nodded.
"But surely, Charlotte, you did nothing of the kind."
He looked around.
"Or did you?"
"No."
"Then there's no more to be said."
I shook my head. "Zachariah," I went on, "the crew seems to side with Jaggery, to think it was me."
"I cannot believe that," he exclaimed.
"Zachariah, it's true." He gazed at me in perplexity.
"Now it is my turn to ask, why?"
"The murder was done with the dirk you gave me."
"What proof is that? Someone must have taken it from your things in the forecastle."
"Zachariah, when I moved to the forecastle, I left it in my cabin."
"Then of course you have nothing to do with it."
"They don't believe I left it there."
"Charlotte, you are not given to lies," he said.
"When you first saw me, Zachariah, did you think that I would ever go before the mast?"
"No."
"Or climb into the rigging during a storm?"
"Not at all."
"Well then, why shouldn't I have murdered Mr. Hollybrass as well? I'm sure that's the way they're thinking." My words silenced him for a few moments. His face clouded. But instead of commenting, he stood up.
I have a store of food and water here. I'll get some.
Securing the candle to a plank, he moved into the darkness. I watched him go, puzzled and troubled by his reaction to what I'd said. While he appeared genuinely surprised, it seemed impossible that he hadn't been told. And indeed, as he vanished into the gloom, a ghastly notion began to fill my head.